Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress. I am a longtime talk radio host out of Washington, D.C., former congressional attorney to Congressman Barney Frank, yada, yada, yada. I'll tell you more about me later. Right now, I want to talk about the 1960s. Have you been watching the all the different CNN documentaries? I think I've seen most of them by now. The one on television, the one on TV, the one on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Really fascinating stuff. Bill Clinton famously said a few years back, and I don't have the exact quote with me, but I remember it, said something to the effect of, ask someone what they think about the 1960s, and their answer will tell you whether or not they're a liberal or a conservative today. If you think, Bill Clinton said, and again, this is a paraphrase, if you think the 1960s were mostly good with a little bit of bad, you're probably a liberal. If you think the 1960s were mostly bad with a little bit of good, you're probably a conservative. I'd actually go further to say, if you think that 1960s was all good, you're far to the left, and if you think it was all bad, you're far to the right. I always thought that was a very perceptive comment from our very perceptive former president. So here's the question. What about the 1960s and the president who so typifies the 1960s, Lyndon Johnson? More so than John F. Kennedy. With all due respect to John F. Kennedy, and of course it's not his fault that he didn't get to finish his first term, I think 60 to 63, that's not the heart of the 60s. When we think about the 60s, we think about 64 to 70. We think about civil rights. We think about the war in Vietnam, which really just the beginnings were happening at the end of Kennedy's. Most of that happened under Lyndon Johnson. And we also think about the war on poverty. We think about programs like Medicare and Medicaid that began in the 1960s. We think about Lyndon Johnson's attempt to do rural electrification and to really try to end poverty in America. Was it a success? Was it a failure? How does it affect how we live today and how we see the 1960s today? To help answer those questions, I've invited Professor Julian Zelizer here. He is a professor at Princeton of American History and an expert in this era. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, I guess the quick and easy question is, do you agree with Bill Clinton that how you view the 60s largely affects your political judgment even to this day?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I mean, I think that the 1960s remain a litmus test, both what actually happened and the myths about what happened. They remain a litmus test for current generation of politicians, of citizens, in terms of how they view the world. You know, a lot happened in that decade, from war to struggles over race relations. And so our memories of them and the way we evaluate them says a lot about where we stand politically today.
Let me ask you about the myths. I find that very interesting because I very much love history. I'm a student of history. What would you say is the biggest myth that we believe today about the 1960s that isn't really true?
Well, I mean, one of the big myths that Lyndon Johnson was this far-left politician, someone who was really, you know, far away from the center of American politics, who had radical ideas about poverty. And in some ways, from the perspective of today, it seems that way because we've become so conservative as a country. But when you look back at the Great Society, at the War on Poverty, a lot of the programs really, you know, were working within our economic system and just wanted to provide some kind of relief and some kind of help to people to become self-sufficient.
Now, help us explain the terms. You're a good professor. I know you can do that. What is the Great Society? Is that different from the War on Poverty?
Well, it's not a precise set of terms, but the Great Society was basically an umbrella term used for all of Lyndon Johnson's programs, from the War on Poverty, which was a program that tried to go in and create smaller pilot programs to get people out of poverty, to civil rights and voting rights, to programs like Medicare and federal education. It was a umbrella term that he used, the Great Society, just to sell what he was doing. And he thought about FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, and the New Deal. That was his catchphrase. So he always wanted a term that he could use the same way.
Okay, so just so I use the term accurately in the future, when you say the Great Society, you mean Lyndon Johnson, specifically domestic programs. It didn't include Vietnam or anything like that.
No, it does not include Vietnam, and that's exactly how to use it.
Okay, and it's not John F. Kennedy's either. It's specifically Lyndon Johnson's
nope.
term. Okay.
John F. Kennedy had his ideas were called the New Frontier. Each president has a little catchphrase. And you know, the main reason they do that is really they think about the media and reporters and the need to explain what you're doing as president. So presidents for a long time have been doing this sort of thing to try to make sense of the various programs that sometimes are a bit disconnected.
So let's talk about the war on poverty. What I find so fascinating about the 1960s politically is this is the era where the parties seem to switch sides. That prior to the 1960s, you find the Democrats are largely defending segregation. They're defending a lot of the conservative structure of America. And if anything, the ones, I mean, after all, Abraham Lincoln was a Republican. Theodore Roosevelt were Republicans. The progressive movement, the old progressive movement, what was out of Republicans. And the 60s seemed to make them switch sides. But I realize it's not all clear cut that way. I guess my question for you is, there was a time, and I'm going back to the old progressive era, when Nebraska, Kansas, William Jennings Bryan, when the people who fought for the poor were the Republican Party. Excuse me. I take that back. Were the Democrat Party. William Jennings Bryan was a Democrat. Were the Democratic Party, but it excluded blacks. And what happened is Lyndon Johnson, by including blacks, somehow lost the Democrats. I don't know if you agree with me.
I think it's correct to say that for much of the 20th century, Southern Democrats, many of them, were champions of programs for the poor. And they championed all kinds of programs, not just economic benefits for the poor, but programs like rural electrification that would help these desolate rural areas. They did that at the same time that they were staunch defenders of Southern segregation and refused to allow any policies that would allow the federal government to say this money comes with strings attached. And so that does come to an end as a result of the Civil Rights Act, and that's no longer a feasible position.
Interesting is that Democrats looked out for the poor when they were poor whites. But as soon as they become poor blacks, suddenly this whole history, again, William Jennings Bryan, of looking out for poor people goes by the wayside. You don't hear too many people in the South talk about Democrats. Well, I guess they're now Democrats. But the old line South, the old line structure used to support people in poverty, and now they don't. And the only thing I can come up with as a reason is civil rights.
Well, that's true. And the other thing is the South became Republican, and the Republican Party that entered that region is very conservative and has little appetite, except rhetorical, for programs that will benefit the poor. And so the party changes a lot after the 1970s. And you started by talking about Bill Clinton. He's a kind of Democrat who often was very uneasy with programs that would help the poor. So that basic mission, I think, is often missing from Democratic politics today.
Where did they go? Where did the Lyndon Johnsons of the world go? Where did the people who fought for unions, fought for poor people, fought for poor white people, okay, even if they were racist, they were fighting for poor people in the 50s for the Democrats. They didn't go to the Republican Party. Obviously, I guess they stayed Democrats. That wing of the Democratic Party stayed Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're still there, and there's many Democrats, especially in Congress and the House of Representatives, who are very supportive of unions and supportive of progressive policies to deal with questions like poverty. But the party also has many other people in it who are not conservative. They're not Reaganites, but they're not really interested in tackling those kinds of questions like fighting poverty because they believe it's suicidal for their party. And I think certainly in the White House and certainly In parts of Congress, those kinds of issues have faded away, and they are not at the heart of the Democratic Party anymore.
Now, Lyndon Johnson grew up pretty poor himself.
That's true. That's true. But so did Bill Clinton. Poverty doesn't always lead that way. But it was very important for Lyndon Johnson. It wasn't just that he was himself struggling at times. It was he was surrounded by poverty. So it was something that he always saw right in front of him.
And he was really motivated. I mean, and we can talk. I mean, he's certainly an ambitious man, and we can talk about all the ways he got to power. But it sounds like this, he had an abiding desire to confront issues of poverty from a very early age.
Oh, absolutely. One of the first things he does while he's in college is he teaches at a local school in Texas that was primarily inhabited by poor Mexican Americans. And he was very moved by that experience. He remembered the kind of struggles that they had, how they, you know, would eat, fruit rinds just to get by. And that had a big impact. And he also remembered the New Deal and the Great Depression in the 1930s when he saw the government literally come in. And he was part of that New Deal administration and saved people from the most desperate conditions they had ever faced.
I wonder what the distinction is in your mind between Lyndon Johnson and so many other poor white Southern Democrats that instead of taking their own experience the way Lyndon Johnson did and reaching out and wanting to help all poor Americans, basically said, if people of color, blacks and Mexicans get rights, then I'm going to be against all poor people. What made Lyndon Johnson be different from, let's face it, what most poor white Southerners did in the 1960s, which wasn't agree with Lyndon Johnson?
Well, part of it is he saw his party changed. And in the late 1950s, there's a lot more Northern liberals who are saying this is just not tolerable, including the person who will become his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, who says we can't be a party of Southern racism anymore. And I think Lyndon Johnson, who was a shrewd politician, understood that. And the other part, I do think, even though he was ambivalent on race relations and ambivalent on civil rights, really did become persuaded by the civil rights movement starting in the mid-1950s that status quo could no longer survive. So I think the movement, I think other people in his party had a huge influence on him beyond his own personal experience.
Professor Selzer, I want to take a break, but when we come back, I want to ask you not about what Johnson believed in, but in the tactics, how he got things done. He was a shrewd politician. That's putting it mildly. I don't know, frankly, any president since Lyndon Johnson as capable as he was at getting something done. And here we are in 2014 with a dysfunctional Congress, and a lot of people are saying President Obama can't get anything done. What could President Obama learn from President Lyndon Johnson? That's my question. 888-653-7543. We'll be right back right after this.
Leslie Marshall. Real people. Real life. Real talk. 888-6-LESLIE.
This is Mark Levine, talking with a terrific guest. His name is Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of American history at Princeton. He's an expert in Lyndon Johnson. We talked about Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. The striking thing about Lyndon Johnson is not just what he did. And again, except for Vietnam, I think his legacy is fantastic. Of course, saying except for Vietnam, some would say the exception trumps the benefits. But in any case, my question for the Professor Zelizer is not just what Lyndon Johnson did, but how he did it. Now, true, he had a Democratic Congress. That certainly helps a lot. But President Obama had a Democratic Congress for 4 years as well. What could President Obama learn from President Lyndon Johnson's way of getting stuff through Congress, or have we so irrevocably changed in the last 50 years that Obama couldn't possibly do half of what Lyndon Johnson did? Professor.
President Obama is not as comfortable as Johnson was with legislative politics, and nor is President Obama someone who had the same level of experience. I mean, Johnson had spent his whole life on Capitol Hill. Obama had barely been in the institution. But I think it's also fair, the point that Obama raises, the times have changed, and he's facing an incredibly difficult Congress. He only had that Democratic majority in the first year in 2010. Republicans retook control of the House. And so he's not only facing a Republican Congress, but a much more polarized Congress. So I think there's limits to some of the lessons of what Lyndon Johnson did. But it also does remind us of the value of having presidents with a lot of experience in the institutions they're going to need to deal with.
So what lessons could President Obama learn from Lyndon Johnson?
Well, I think the biggest lesson, and one that's been hard for President Obama, isn't just the wheeling and dealing. It's his loyalty and connection to the grassroots movements that could help him. So Lyndon Johnson benefited tremendously from the civil rights movement, and that helped him, along with organized labor, get a lot of bills through. Obama's always had tepid relations with the union movement. He's had tepid relations with the progressive movement, always thinking it's politically safe to keep a distance. But I think in some ways they might have helped him build the support he needed to overcome this kind of legislative paralysis.
This is very interesting because activists in the street really do make a difference and really do help a president.
Absolutely, and that's something, you know, not just in the 60s. You could see that in the 1930s during the New Deal. It was essential for FDR. It was essential to Reagan and the conservative movement. And they shouldn't be forces that are pushed aside for political expediency. I think they often can be incredibly helpful to the White House.
Okay, but how much of that was Lyndon Johnson's doing? When I think about the 60s, I think the civil rights was sort of sui generis. The people there were doing it themselves. Vietnam, people were angry. They were marching in the streets. How much did Lyndon Johnson actually encourage the protests?
He didn't encourage them, and sometimes he didn't like them, but what he did was understand when they were changing the political atmosphere, and he responded accordingly. That was really one of his great strengths. So he is definitely not responsible for the movement, but he was very skilled at understanding when the movement had changed legislative conditions to the point he could push his bills.
Did he work with the movement activists after a time? At first he didn't, but once we get to 65, 60, 67, was there a working relationship between, say, Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson?
Oh, he does that as early as 64. He meets with them in the White House in January and is talking strategy, not just on civil rights, but how to build pressure for the war on poverty. Constantly relies on union leaders to help him move bills from the war on poverty to education. So he was turning to them all the time, and they had a seat in the Oval Office in a way that today is hard to imagine. So those relations were quite important.
Professor Zelizer, I want to thank you for your time. Fascinating discussion, and let that be a lesson, Mr. President, if you're listening to the show right now. Oh, we only got like 10 seconds. Give me the name of the book, and I'll bring it up when we come back. All right.
It's called The Fierce Urgency of Now.
The Fierce Urgency of Now. Go buy that book. This is Mark Levine, back after this.
Put something worthwhile on your iPod or MP3 player. LeslieMarshallShow.com/members.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. I really enjoyed that discussion with Professor Zelizer. Really good stuff. I hope to have him back. Great lesson for President Obama. Really, really important lesson that Lyndon Johnson could teach him from the grave. Listen up, Mr. President. Don't give up your progressive allies. We can help you. You can help us. We can help you. Work with the unions. Work with civil rights organizations. Work with women's groups. Work with gay rights organizations. Work with your base. Work with us. Work with the environmental movement. We are on your side. We can help you. You can help us. Lyndon Johnson had union people in his office all the time. Turn to them. Turn to Martin Luther King. They discuss the marches. There is no connection, it seems today, between activists inside and outside the White House. And there needs to be. In fact, I'm going to tell you a little bit later on in a bit about my experience as one of the founders of the marriage equality movement, talking exactly how we used an inside-outside strategy to get things accomplished. So many activists, and I look at the Occupy movement. They meant well. They had strong ideals. They had pretty good organizing skills. They didn't get much accomplished because they had no road inside. And there are plenty of politicians inside, like President Obama, that mean well, are trying hard, but don't get much accomplished because they have no ties to the outside. Professor Zelizer, and I didn't know where he was going with this. I was just asking him questions. He said exactly what I believe, which is the combination of an inside and an outside strategy that most gets things accomplished. I'd like to know if Mark from San Francisco agrees. If you want to call in, by the way, it's 888-653-7543. Mark from San Francisco, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, I want to totally agree with you. I think that's a really good point, that President Obama tried to appease the Republican Party and make deals with them. He went wrong there. He should have stuck with the base, and we had his back, and he didn't really go with that. He kind of tried to make deals with the Republicans, and all they were out to do was sabotage him. And another thing I wanted to bring up is what's different about today opposed to Lyndon Johnson's days. The Republican Party is, to me, a real danger to this country. They're out to sabotage the country and basically hurt the economy, hurt President Obama, to basically further their agenda to turn this country over to the rich and the corporations.
It's certainly true of a lot of them. When I look at the Tea Party wing of the Republicans, that's the most nihilist part of the party, you know, nihilism, believing that basically in destruction. It's an old Leninist strategy, ironically. Lenin believed you had to destroy in order to save, that basically the only way that he could take over power was to destroy everything that existed. That seems to me, you know, Mitch McConnell said from, I think, a week into the Obama presidency back in 2009, that when they asked him what his primary goal was it the economy, which was in free fall? Was it anything else, any part of the Republican agenda? He said his goal was to make President Obama a one-term president. He said that a week into his presidency. This isn't after 5 or 6 years of gridlock and anger. This is right at the feet of a new president. So you're absolutely right. They are the party of no. But I got to tell you, Mark, I don't hear Democrats saying that so much anymore. I remember talking about the party of no in 2009, in 2010, in 2011, in 2012. The fact that they hate Obamacare, but they have no proposal to replace the Affordable Care Act. They Just the other day, we were talking about President Obama's way to hire more immigration judges and speed up the deportation process, which Republicans say they want for the migrant children. Frank, as a Democrat, I don't really want to speed up that process, but Republicans want that process sped up. Obama says, okay, I need money to do it. And they say, no, we can't give you a legislative win.
Well, the reason why they're doing that is because they want this to continue and blame Obama for this. And they're not interested in solving problems. They're interested in basically defeating Democrats so that they can further the agenda of the Koch brothers, Grover Norquist, who they take pledges to. And basically, to me, they're a threat to this country because they don't care about anything but profits and profits for their corporate masters. And it is a threat to this country as far as I'm concerned. And
I agree, Mark,
with you. The Democrats should stand up to them because basically they have the moral high ground and they need to hammer it home. These Republicans are scary.
Here's the problem, Mark. You live in San Francisco. I happen to live in Northern Virginia. I think we're the most liberal area of the country, except for San Francisco. You win, okay? I mean, in San Francisco, I think the question is whether it's going to be the Democrat or the Green, the liberal Democrat or the leftist. You know, it's amazing. My concern is that everything you say, and I agree with every word you say, is not getting out to the people of Tennessee and West Virginia and Idaho, the white people, I should say. It's not getting out to including lower working class people. I'm not just talking about the Wall Street barons. It seems that working class white people in the South and in rural environments aren't hearing what you and I are saying from Northern Virginia and from D.C. and from San Francisco. What are we missing? What in your view?
Well, I think one thing is the Democratic Party needs to basically get louder, get more aggressive, and more determined to defeat the Republican Party. That's one. Number two is, to me, we're seeing also the shutting off of airwaves of progressive voices.
That's for sure. I can tell you as a talk radio host, that happens all the time.
Yeah, and it's hurting because people aren't getting educated or getting the news, the real news, of what's going on in this country. I think that that's really the big problem. I feel that not only is the Republican Party a threat, it's also that we're not, the corporate media is also not helping because they're not informing people of what's going on with this Republican Party and what they're trying to do to the country. It's being muffled, and they're trying to dumb down the American people from hearing the truth, and I think that is as big a problem as corporate trying to take over our government.
I'll tell you, Mark, in the 1960s, since that's where we started this conversation, in the 1970s, Walter Cronkite would come on the air. And you knew, or at least people knew or thought at that time, that whatever Walter Cronkite said was truth. If Walter Cronkite reported it, it happened. That's the way it was. That's the way it is. That's Walter Cronkite. And when Walter Cronkite came out against the war in Vietnam, oh, my God, everyone came out against the war in Vietnam. When Walter Cronkite said that Joe McCarthy, you know, had suggested he'd gone too far, it was Edward R. Murrow. When the people in charge of the news said that, that's where the country went. Today, we have this weird media environment, as much as part of the internet as anything else, where you Google what you want, and if you're a Democrat and you Google an article about FDR, it'll tell you all the good parts of the New Deal. If you're a Republican and you Google FDR, it'll tell you why FDR was a terrible president. I mean, literally, it's not just the world of Fox and MSNBC. We are being fed what we already believe. We're not talking to people who disagree with us. In fact, I want to bring some Republican guests on the air so I can debate them, so I can give you a chance to do that. But I think that partly we have this splintered media that we didn't have in the 1960s.
Absolutely. Thanks for the conversation. It was interesting.
Thank you, Mark. I think you have to go get your doorbell. Thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. Folks, if you want to call in, it's 888-653-7543 and join this discussion. The question is, what can we do? What can President Obama do? He still has 2.5 years left. What can he do? What would you do? We'll be right back after this.
Leslie Marshall, the simple truth in a complicated world. 888-6-LESLIE. Spending a dollar a song? Spend less than $5 a month and have Leslie year-round. Go to LeslieMarshallShow.com/members.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Levine. One of the great lessons of the war on poverty, what Lyndon Johnson taught us, what Lyndon Johnson could teach President Obama, was that you got to work both inside and outside. Great lesson Professor Zelizer shared with us. And it's this inside and outside connection that makes us strong. This is Mark Levine. Leslie Marshall is gone this week. I am glad to be with you. I want to read some of the tweets that I have and also invite you to call in at 888-653-7543. A few said they didn't know about whether or not the war on poverty worked. Steve writes, the original concept was great, but the GOP has now switched it to a war on the poor. I agree with you, Steve. David Lehman writes, war on poverty was amazingly bad for blacks and great for Democratic candidates. Bad for blacks? I'm not sure I agree with you on that, David, but if you want to call in, let me know why. I'd be curious to know what you're talking about. 888-653-7543. RJ writes, it was a total failure, a destructive failure. Really? Destructive failure. I mean, we still have more work to do, to be sure, about a destructive failure. Bill writes, the Welfare Reform Act signed by Clinton in 96 was a major joke. Okay. A lot say it was not a success. If you want to follow me on Twitter and add your 2 cents, please do, at Mark Levine Talk. Let's go to Kurt in Los Angeles. Kurt, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Mark? Thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Hey, I hope I'm not off base here with my topic, but it kind of hits on the war on poverty. But at the same time, it also, I believe, can be a solution to getting money out of politics. And if you allow me to expand a little bit, I will.
I would love a way to get money out of politics. I've been working for that myself. I'm all ears. Go ahead.
Okay, well, over the past, I'd say, 15 years since George Bush got in the White House and the 10 years or 8 years we had to deal with him and the few years since, I've noticed that there are a lot of corporations that periodically raise their prices, which raises the cost of living for most people because a lot of these corporations are utilities. And then they turn around and they use their corporate profits to give to a company called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council.
Yeah, it's not a company. It's a lobbying outfit. It's actually something put forward by the Koch brothers and others to lobby state governments. So you're absolutely right, but it's not a company. It's a lobbying firm. A lobbying organization, better to call it.
Okay, whatever. They're an entity. Okay.
American Legislative Exchange
Council.
There you go. They're a council. Go ahead.
Right. And if people want to know more about it, they can go to a website called alecexposed.org. alecexposed.org. Okay. And that's a wonderful website that will inform everyone about what exactly they do and how it's hurting our country. But the point of my call is that
for those who don't know, just real quick, ALEC takes hundreds of millions of dollars anonymously. They won't tell who their donors are. We know the Koch brothers are behind some of it. But basically, they take hundreds of millions of dollars. And one of the really nefarious things they do is they don't usually spend a lot of money on the presidential race, which actually is the race that's probably least affected by money because most of us have a view on the president. They tend to do it in state legislative races where people don't even know who the candidates are. And most people don't even vote. So 90% of the people aren't voting. A little money goes a long way in those races. And if you want to know why we have a Republican House of Representatives, even though the majority of Americans voted for Democrats in 2012, we do because they drew the district lines in a way to make sure that Republicans get 5-10% more than were voted for. And that's all because of state legislative boundaries. And that's all because of ALEC. So if you got a problem with Congress today, it starts right there at the state level. And it starts with groups like ALEC. Go ahead, Kurt.
Exactly. Well put. I couldn't have said it better. That's why you're the host and I'm not. But
No. I'm glad you brought it up. Keep going.
Yeah. Well, let me add my 2 cents, though.
Please.
Here's the thing. Okay. Personally, I've noticed that during midterm elections and even the presidential election, I noticed that there are some companies that will have a spike in their prices, i.e. some of the gas companies. Okay, the fossil fuel companies. And I noticed one particular week after Mitt Romney had lost the second debate and it was down to the wire, I noticed that the cost of the pump spiked like 30 to 40 cents in one particular week. And they tried to blame it on some type of refinery issue, but there was none. No one could find any evidence of a refinery issue. Then, within that same week, Mitt Romney received a $2 million influx of cash from ExxonMobil in donations. Because I found that on opensource.org, which is another place you can go to find out where money's going to certain candidates. And it dawned on me that some of these companies are literally taking their profits and giving it straight to Republican candidates to try to win these elections, whether it's local or federal. And then
It's a good point. And let me just expound on that a bit, and then I'll let you go further. Think about why for-profit corporations give to the Republican Party. If you are a for-profit corporation, if you run one, you're a CEO. You can't actually be one because they're not people. But if you run a for-profit corporation and you give money to a politician, there are only two possibilities. Either that politician will react based on your cash or he or she won't react based on your cash. If that politician isn't going to do anything based on your cash, if you're giving a politician $1 million and he or she isn't going to do nothing, you have wasted your money. You have violated your fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders. You're throwing money in the toilet. So obviously CEOs believe their money's buying something. Now, if your money is buying something, if you are getting some taxpayer dollars back, remember, you're a for-profit corporation. You're not giving money because you're pro-choice or pro-life or pro-gun control or pro-NRA or whatever, or pro-civil rights. You're giving money as a corporation because you're going to get money back. You give a politician $1 million and he grabs taxpayer dollars and gives you $1 billion. If you are getting that quid pro quo, which obviously you think you're getting or you wouldn't be spending the money, that's what I call bribery. And it may well be legal, but it shouldn't be. It's criminal. And I'd like to throw both the politician and the corporation in jail. The United States Supreme Court has said by 5-4 in a ridiculous decision called Citizens United that this bribery, and I don't know what else you call it, that basically paying a politician, giving that politician money so he can grab a whole bunch of taxpayer dollars and give it to you, is perfectly legal.
Right.
And it's just very important to spell it out because a lot of people don't really see the problem with it. It is legalized bribery. It's that simple.
Exactly. Now, here's my solution that I like to try to get a movement to. Okay?
All right.
Now, back in the old days of shopping, when you go to back in the 70s and 80s when I was a kid, okay, if my little league team or a football team, we needed a sponsor, we could always go down to the corner store, department store guy, get them to put sponsor our football team, you know, put an ad in our local newspaper or something supporting us. And the money went from the local businesses back into the school, back into the parks, back into your community, and life was good. Now, if you don't have a stadium that a corporation can put their name on, they won't deal with your community. They just want a tax break, and they suck the community dollars if they pay taxes at all, because Walmart, they get such a break, they don't pay anything into the schools, into the roads or anything. They get all these tax breaks. And so we pay taxes on what you buy, but then they defer their taxes and don't pay anything to the local community. So as far as I'm concerned, they're a bad act.
It actually gets worse than that. There's something called inversion. Which people need to be aware of. Inversion is when a United States company, an American company, that basically serves 90% Americans and makes its products here and all its workers are here, looks out and says, oh, here's a company in the Cayman Islands, or here's a company in Ireland, or here's a company in a country with a very, very small tax base. Let's buy it. Let's buy this post office box service in the Cayman Islands that has one employee and costs us $100,000, almost nothing. Then we're going to move our corporate headquarters, which have been in Cleveland, Ohio for the last 70 years, where we make steel, and I'm making it up. I don't mean to attack a steel company per se. And we're going to put it in the Cayman Islands, and we'll still serve 90% Americans, and we'll still make our products 100% in America. But by moving our address, by signing over some paperwork, lo and behold, we don't have to pay American taxes. We have to pay Cayman Island taxes. One of the things President Obama is trying to do is trying to pass legislation that says, you traders, you companies, you American companies, you should not be able to simply say, I don't want to pay American taxes, I'm going to pretend I'm a Cayman Island company. Now, anyone who cares about the United States of America would say, well, of course that's not fair. Of course these American companies should pay American taxes, but this bill is going nowhere because Republicans apparently support what I would call traitors. They support people, companies, who leave the United States of America and leave their country behind. And so you're absolutely right about the taxes. I appreciate
you. Now let me try to get to the solution now.
All right, real quick, Kurt, because I got to take a break real quickly. So give me like 10 seconds. I'll give you more afterwards. Go ahead.
Right. Corporations want to be treated as people, right?
Right.
Well, I believe we have a right as consumers to spend money with people who we like.
True.
Do business with people that are going to be favorable to you.
So boycott. It's all about boycott. Tell you what, Kurt, I'm sorry I have to take a break. It's the top of the hour, and it's a hard break. You're welcome to stay on, and anyone else can join us at 888-653-7543. This is Mark Levine. Follow me on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk.
Rumor has it he quotes the Constitution in his sleep. Is it super nerd? No, it's Mark Levine.
Because Mark Levine is with me, co-host every hump day here in this hour on the only true democracy in talk radio. Now, Mark, as you know, is a former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank in the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committees. He also hosts his own talk show, nationally syndicated, right before this hour, Monday through Friday, on the Leslie Marshall Show Network. Mark, good to have you with us, and good to talk to you. I think I was on vacation one day and, you know, sick one day, whatever. But let's talk about one of my favorite subjects, at least to talk about on Fox News as of late, and that's Hillary Clinton.
Well, of course, they've got to attack Hillary. That's their biggest threat. So
yeah.
I guarantee you we're going to have only several thousand more shows that are anti-Hillary between now and November 2016.
Agreed. You know, people are saying you don't erase your emails unless you're trying to hide something. As you all know, I am DQ delete queen, so that is not true. You know, we know that they can be retrieved from the server. We know that there was, you know, emails handed over. All of the emails are being handed over. Hillary's like, hand them all over. Quote, I have repeatedly said I want those emails out. First of all, there are on the extreme right almost allegations that there may have been something illegal going on here. Now, there's a discovery of, you know, there was a second email address. Before we get to politically, when she was Secretary of State, how much outside, you know, the realm of everybody in a position like this is this? Take us to reality, which certainly many media outlets don't with regard to these emails.
Well, first of all, you have to understand the Republicans have a job to do, and that's to take down any Democratic president or nominee as much as they possibly can. I mean, you may recall, I'm sure you do, Leslie, back in the 90s, there were allegations that Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton murdered Vince Foster. You know, one of their aides committed suicide. There were allegations about Barack Obama.
Yeah, that to me, between that comes second to the questioning, and it was effective, unfortunately, the Swift Boat veterans, John Kerry's service.
Another example.
Yeah.
Or challenging Barack Obama's birthplace. I mean, ridiculous,
right.
Ridiculous allegations.
Right.
So to the extent that it doesn't exit the right-wing bubble, I'm not particularly concerned about it. This is just the right-wing making up crazy stuff. You know, to the extent that she has emails, they should be disclosed. As she's pointed out, it's not up to her to disclose them. They don't belong to her. They belong to the State Department. It's their property. State Department says it'll come out in January. She said, I want it out way sooner than that. And it's up to them. And I think it would behoove everybody, Hillary Clinton and the State Department and the Republican critics, everybody, bring them out as soon as possible. But I don't think anyone could argue at this point that she's hiding anything. The argument is that she shouldn't have done it in the first place. All right, she made a mistake. I just don't think that's a presidential denying mistake.
You know, this, to me, I have said, and I think we agree on this, people on the left, even if they're Bernie Sanders, if she becomes the nominee, they're going to rally behind her. People on the right aren't going to vote for her. It's the people who don't want to, you know, align or subscribe with the left or the right. There are independents that are centrist, that consider themselves not just independent, but, you know, don't want to be part of the Democratic or Republican Party, that she has to worry about. And speaking of worry about, these emails aren't something voters really worry about, are they?
I don't think so. I actually think a better argument can be made about the money, except that to the extent that Clinton is bad, the Republicans are worse. This has always been my feeling about Democrats and Republicans and money. Democrats are bad. They take money from all kinds of groups that I wish they wouldn't take from. But the Republicans are so far worse that on a lesser of two evils scale, obviously the Democrats are better. And there are some on the far left that say, you know, I hate both parties because they take money. But the money, unfortunately, is what is required. I support public financing. So, by the way,
way does Hillary Clinton. She's very much opposed to Citizens United. In the meantime, though, everyone's raising billions of dollars to run for president. She is. The Republicans are. Everyone is. It's a terrible system, but you got to play by the system you have until we get a better system. So
even Senator Sanders is just in a different way. You know, he's doing it more of a grassroots effort online. There's so much as you talk about here. So politically, we agree this isn't really going to bring her down. I want to talk about Sidney Blumenthal. This is a man who was not working for the State Department when Mrs. Clinton was Secretary of State. This is a man that had worked for the Clinton Foundation and the Clintons in the past, but bottom line, he was not her employee. He was not an employee of the State Department or of the federal government. This is a private citizen who on his private computer sent an email to a friend. When we come back, we're going to talk about the legality of this and the continuing saga of the numerous Benghazi investigations that we're footing the bill for, America. I'm Leslie Marshall. We'll be back with Mark Levine and you right after this. Pick up the phone and join us if you want. 888-6-LESLIE, 888-653-7543. Don't go away. Back. I'm Leslie Marshall. He's Mark Levine. He is in D.C. I am in Los Angeles. We are bi-coastal team, coast to coast, every hump day here on the only true democracy in talk radio. Now, Mark, before the break, I was talking about Sidney Blumenthal. Do you think this is unprecedented, A, and B, do you think this is the reason this is a closed-door interview? Because, I mean, technically, this doesn't really have anything to do with Benghazi, and this is at the expense of the taxpayer for a Benghazi investigation. We know this is nothing more than a witch hunt to try and find something to take Hillary and Clinton down politically in her run for president.
Sure. I don't know. Maybe that's why it's closed door. I mean, look, so Sidney Blumenthal is someone who's sort of someone who's done a lot of stuff for the Clintons in the past. He was doing his own sort of business lobbying effort in Libya. He heard all kinds of things there, some true, some false, everything in between, and apparently he sent emails to Hillary saying, hey, Hillary, this is what's going on in Libya. Sometimes he's right, sometimes he's wrong, and Hillary sent it to others, sometimes to Ambassador Stevens, you know, hey, this is what Sidney Blumenthal says, and sometimes it's clear she took it with a grain of salt. I'm not sure what the scandal is here.
Thank you.
You and me, Leslie, we get letters all the time, and I appreciate that, and send it to at Mark Levine Talk. We get tweets, we get emails by all kinds of people, you and me, and they say, I think this happened, I think this happened. And when that happens, I thank someone for sending something to me, and then I check it out. And sometimes it's exactly true, and it's a great, great scoop, and I thank someone, and they laid me on to something, and I may do a show about it. Sometimes it turns out to be completely false. It's a wild conspiracy theory. I check it out. It has no basis in fact. And oftentimes I tell the person, hey, you know, this just isn't true. And sometimes it's just sort of something I already knew. And some, you know, so people send me advice all the time. I'm sure when you're Hillary Clinton, you get 1,000 times more advice than you or I get, Leslie. And this is from someone who's a close friend for many years, and he sent her stuff. And I'm not sure what the issue is.
I'm not either, because she, for the most part, like you said, there are a couple that were forwarded to Ambassador Stevens, and there are emails that were forwarded to other people, and there's one email in which she questions specifically, she says, I don't find this very credible, do you?
Right.
And her
right.
her staff largely dismissed this. So, you know, I'm with you. I think this is a guy that's worked for them. He's a friend. He's trying to be helpful, and because he's a friend, you know, she's just like, here, do what you will with this. You know, like,
yeah,
here,
exactly.
FYI. If it's helpful, great. If not, but this is not him working for her. This is
right.
not the request and bequest. You know, this is a guy that's trying to be helpful, even though he wasn't asked and really wasn't helpful at all.
I mean, Leslie, you must get emails from friends of yours.
Tons.
Saying, hey, I think you should look into this story. And they tell you something, and maybe they got something that you don't know, which is fantastic. Most of the time you know it already, and sometimes it's just false. And you're like, well, thanks, I'll look into it. And that's just what friends do when you're on the radio. Like I said, I mean, she's in a much more powerful position than you or I.
Right.
That's all I see it as. It's sort of an unrequested email. And she's like, okay, Libya folk, this is what Sidney Blumenthal says. He does have people on the ground in Libya. They are trying for a business venture, by the way, that never went anywhere, but they were trying to do this like floating hospital for the wounded of Libya, whatever. It didn't go anywhere. He's hearing stuff on the ground. Can you look into this? Maybe there's something there. And most of the time there wasn't anything there, but I'm not sure what she did wrong. I can't even articulate it.
It reminds me of my son when he's like, is that all you've got, Mom? So much to talk about. I just saw on Twitter during the break something that really made me laugh. It's a picture of Hillary, and it says below it, I deleted them all. Right? And I mean, that, it doesn't say it that way, but that's how I read it. And I laughed, and I laughed my butt off, and I'll tell you why. Do we really think that Hillary Rodham Clinton is sitting at her computer pressing delete, 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 or in the server with a nail file, like screwing with that piece of equipment? I mean, this is to me so beyond the level of ignorance. It's an insult on the soul of the American people, if you will. This is like with the Clinton Foundation. I'm going to tie that in here, and I want your take on it. The Clinton Foundation was not founded by her. It was founded by her husband. Right. The Clinton Foundation is not all about her. And are we really so stupid to believe that every time a donation comes in, somebody texts her and goes, hey, Prince from Saudi Arabia, where women are being oppressed, just wrote us a check for $7 million. You know what I mean? I mean, seriously, like at my level, yes, if somebody writes me a check, I'm going to know who it is, how much it is. So let's talk about this idea that she's everywhere and does everything all by herself.
There was a time 40 years ago when a president of the United States could put an 18-and-a-half-minute gap in a certain tape and actually erase the evidence. And I have no doubt that Nixon did that or ordered that. You can't do that anymore. As you point out, Leslie, they're all on
the server. Or
shred anyway.
Documents after the Iran-Contra affair?
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, I'm not quite sure what it is they think she's hiding, but all of this stuff is well accessible in servers, and frankly, the NSA probably has a copy of it. Everything anyway. I'm just not sure what they think is the big secret here. She made an administrative error. It was wrong. We all make mistakes. I got a parking ticket the other day. She made an administrative error. She did, you know, I'm running for office. You know that, Leslie. I'm running for state delegate in Virginia. I have a new email address based on my delegate race. I also continue to use my old email address. And lo and behold, I'm going to admit to something here. Sometimes I accidentally send something related to my delegate race from my personal email address, and sometimes someone sends me a personal email on my delegate.
Call the police, Mark and Andrew, at once.
Exactly.
The FBI, the CIA, Homeland Security. Immediately.
Arrest me now. Sometimes I hit the wrong button and it goes to the wrong email address. I'm not sure what else this is.
And speaking of, okay, when people are, I was on Sean Hannity's radio show a couple of days ago, in which one sentence he professed his love for me and said he wanted to strangle me at the same time. And it was.
He only wants to strangle me, Leslie. It's one way. I don't get the love. But go ahead.
And he doesn't want to strangle me in that good, like, erotica kind of way. But
TMI.
His issue, as many on the right, is that Hillary is so pro-women. How could an organization take money from anybody in a country that doesn't let women drive? And I'm like, as a woman, that's not the issue. I'd love to have somebody drive me around. Thank you very much. You know, but she also has visited these countries as First Lady, as Secretary of State, and even as Secretary of State, she's powerless to stop honor killings in Jordan, powerless to stop at the time, and hopefully that's changing very soon, women not being able to vote, hold jobs or certain jobs, or drive, as an example, or what they wear, or the oppression that is on women in Saudi Arabia and other countries, just as neither can Michelle Obama or Laura Bush or Nancy Reagan or Barbara Bush could when or if they visited those countries. And I say that because a lot of people say, well, Giuliani had money and, you know, from a Middle East organization that, spoke ill of the United States after 9/11, he gave the money back. Apples and oranges, though, don't you think?
The sheer hypocrisy of this. Sean Hannity knows well that the Bush administration had extremely close ties to Saudi Arabia, including business interests, by the way, not just political ties.
They would say George Bush didn't put himself out there as a feminist and poster child for a leader in women's rights.
That. And not only did he have that, but his father had that. This relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, flawed though it is, goes back many, many, many decades. And it just, if someone from the National Organization for Women wants to make the argument that Hillary Clinton, or more specifically, the Clinton Foundation, Bill Clinton, should not have taken money from Saudi Arabia, I'll wake up. I'll listen. I'll hear their argument. For Sean Hannity to make that argument is the ultimate hypocrisy.
Talk to me about this, too. The Clinton Foundation is a charity, and I say that because we got a hell of a lot of Republicans on the right who are taking money from a lot of people. To be fair, shouldn't we see the list of their donors, or does that not count because they're to super PACs and not to charities that actually help to reduce, as Clinton Foundation has hugely contributed to, the reduction of AIDS and death from AIDS?
I made this exact same argument, too, speaking of Sean Hannity, a few weeks ago. I said, look, this is charitable money.
Oh, you on his TV show or his radio show?
No, his radio show. Oh. I said that this is charitable money, that it's going to a bunch of charitable purposes. It's not used by the Clintons in any way. And they've disclosed 90-odd percent of it, and you're arguing over the 10% that they haven't disclosed, probably less than 10%. Compare that to Jeb Bush, who has 100% of his money not disclosed in a secret PAC that he's getting a nonprofit charitable tax deduction for, even though all of it goes directly to the pockets of his campaign. This isn't some charity. This isn't Sean Hannity Jeb Bush curing disease. This is Jeb Bush using the money for his political campaign. We don't know how much came from foreign donors. We have no idea. He discloses none of it. And I said, if you're going to talk about Hillary Clinton, you really should talk about Jeb Bush. At which point he said to me, if I mention Jeb Bush's name again, he's going to cut me off the show. He's only talking about Hillary Clinton. That's the ultimate hypocrisy. He doesn't want to hold his people to a much lighter standard than he wants to hold Hillary Clinton.
And speaking of, again, these people are preaching to the choir.
Whether
it's with Blumenthal, with emails, with the Clinton Foundation's money,
right. This
is – I don't think an independent is going to say, oh, hell, I'm not voting for her because that person gave a check to her husband's charity.
Look, I hate money in politics. I support getting rid of Citizens United. So does Hillary Clinton. I don't like the standards we have now for political campaigns. I support pure public financing of campaigns. So does Hillary Clinton. But given what we have now, to unilaterally disarm and to say, well, the Republicans can get all the funny money they want from whatever source and not disclose it, and Democrats can't take any money unless it's all perfectly disclosed, it's if you're allowed to kick below the belt, and that's the rule, then you shouldn't not do that, because as bad as it is, you're getting kicked there, and you got to fight fire with fire. We cannot have an election against Republicans where they're allowed to break the rules, or there are no rules. They're allowed to do some squirrely things, and Democrats can't follow the same stuff. It's let's change the rules of the game.
And let's talk about today. I also heard, well, she's not getting endorsements from de Blasio or from Elizabeth Warren. Nobody's getting endorsements left or right. It's too early in the game, right?
I mean, I don't know who's saying that. I think it's a weird thing to say. I think that the nomination is still a year away?
Yeah.
And I'm quite confident that Elizabeth Warren will endorse the Democratic nominee. I think it's going to be Hillary Clinton. But I don't know who's saying this, but that's a very weird thing to say. I don't think Jeb Bush is getting all the endorsements he wants either.
Let's talk about trade, because the TPP and, fast track and all that has definitely been something that people left and right can agree on, and that obviously liberals disagree with the president on, so there's been some fragmentation within the Democratic Party about. During a roundtable, Hillary signaled some agreement with her liberal critics on TPP. Talk to me about this, and because this does weigh into maybe some people who are on the fence about her voting-wise.
It's a fair question. I think it is more of a intra-democratic question, with President Obama on one side and critics like Elizabeth Warren on the other. I frankly agree with the critics like Elizabeth Warren who say that unless we know what's in the deal, we shouldn't agree to fast-track authority. I'm not willing to give the president the benefit of the doubt on this, particularly when he's looking at dictatorships like Malaysia and Vietnam. They definitely can undercut American labor. I'm less concerned about Japan, an industrialized democracy. But whatever it is, I think he should let us know the truth. I think Hillary's trying to play the middle, and it's a tough game to play, frankly, with TPP. I think that, there are a few Democrats who switched votes and helped President Obama on that just recently. She'll probably have to come a little bit more clean. She's going to be hit on her left by Bernie Sanders, by Martin O'Malley. I think she's going to have to take the Elizabeth Warren side of that argument because I think the majority of Democrats agree with me that on this particular issue, Elizabeth Warren has it right and Barack Obama has it wrong. It's kind of a progressive versus establishment Democratic issue, and I think more Democrats agree with the progressives than the establishment. So I guess I'd say I think she hasn't completely answered that question. She's going to have to answer it more as time goes on.
Speaking of, some people would say that I've seen sound bites of her today talking about the rich CEOs on Wall Street and rich people of these corporations, and there are a lot of people getting on her for how much she got paid for speaking and that she is one of these millionaires, billionaires that she's referencing. Talk to me about her wealth. Is that a problem when you're talking about the income gap and income inequality and disparity in wages when she and her husband combined have so much money, A? And B, why is it a problem that she was making a living between being Secretary of State and running for president?
You know, I look at the two greatest liberal families in the 20th century in America, and the two I think about are the Roosevelts and the Kennedys. Both of them were extremely wealthy families who worked very hard to look out for working-class people, for poor people, for middle-class people. That's what they did. And no one seemed to say, aha, Franklin Roosevelt, Eleanor Roosevelt, you don't care about ordinary people. Or the Kennedys. You don't care about ordinary people because you're so rich. Robert Kennedy made his whole movement of caring for ordinary people. The issue is what you focus on, what your concerns are. Democrats don't hate rich people. There's nothing wrong with being rich. What's wrong is having a system of government and economics that favors the rich over the poor. And the Roosevelts and Kennedys certainly understood that. They were very wealthy, but they were working to help make the system more fair for everyone. And I think that's what Hillary Clinton's trying to do.
We're going to be going to Talk Radio News Service after this break, and time just flew. Look forward to having you back more than just an hour when your election is done, which I certainly hope that you're successful in.
Two weeks and 6 days, Leslie.
You're going to win this one. I got a good feeling.
I hope so. Thank you.
But I thought you were going to win the last one, and you should.
Well.
we'll see. I look forward to calling up. I don't know. What happens when you are someday truly a congressman? Do I call you Mark or congressman?
You can always call me Mark.
All right. He is Mark Levine. Follow him on Twitter at Mark Levine Talk. That's with an E for empathy, L-E-V-I-N-E. And on the website, marklevinetalk.com. You can hear him 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday, right before me here on the Only True Democracy and Talk Radio. We'll be back right after this Talk Radio News Service live from our nation's capital coming up.